Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, we return to Phyllis Bennis's extremely interesting talk on why a military response to ISIS cannot work, but diplomacy can. I hope you'll stay tuned. We return to the interesting talk Phyllis Bennis recently gave in Seattle. Bennis is a highly regarded researcher and progressive activist. She has a particular interest in Middle Eastern affairs and U.S. foreign policy. In Seattle, she spoke on the militant Islamist extremist group ISIS. She showed how U.S. military interventions in the Middle East help create ISIS, especially our disastrous war and even more disastrous occupation of Iraq. Another cause of ISIS is the 8 or 9 disastrous proxy wars now being waged in Syria. Not all of these Syrian conflicts are our fault, but some are. Bennis argues that all U.S. military actions in the Middle East have failed. Necessarily failed. That includes all military actions taken against ISIS in recent months. They too have failed. She argues that there is no military solution to the problem of ISIS. Rather than further escalate the war against ISIS, we need diplomacy and negotiation. And if you think that war can solve this problem, but negotiating with militants cannot, I'll just add two words. Northern Ireland. When we paused the talk last week, Bennis was discussing the huge economic costs to Americans of our military response to ISIS. Today she'll continue with a big reason that some powerful people want a military response to ISIS, even if that response cannot work. That's because war brings big profits to the fat cats who own the so-called defense industries. Here again is Phyllis Bennis.
What makes us safer? Jobs and health care? And education at home? Or wasting our money on wars around the world that make people hate us and turn against us and turn to terrorism? We hear so often, no one wants war. It's not true. It's never been true. There are powerful forces who want war because they profit from war. The old saying, cui bono, who profits? Still, follow the money. That's still the answer here. Those who profit are the ones who want the war. You know, in all of history, people who produce war goods, the weapons, that sort of thing, have always been wealthy, always been powerful, the war profiteers. But if you look at U.S. history, more recently, in the period right after 9/11, in that first year, the war profiteers, the CEOs of war-producing companies, got a 200% raise on average. All the other overpaid CEOs got a 7% raise. Now you tell me they don't want war. They want war because it's profitable. They want war because they want a market for all of their military goods. And they find it. Because we are told over and over again it's either war or nothing. And that's the lie. It's the lie that George Bush told us overtly. It's the lie that current administrations and Congresses continue to act on. So we have this ongoing conflict in the region, across the region, some of them new. Some are old. The question of Israel-Palestine remains central to the crisis in the region. If you look at the positive days of the Arab Spring, when it looked so hopeful, so optimistic, that citizens' organizations, citizens' movements, democratic movements were rising all around the region, and the demands were the demands of the rights of citizenship, and the demands were for jobs and for bread. They were basic rights. But if you talk to any of those activists, you didn't have to scratch the surface very hard to find out that part of the anger that motivated it was seeing how Palestinians were being treated over the decades. seeing the expansion of settlements, seeing the siege of Gaza continuing over and over again, and every 2 years a new assault on Gaza with thousands of Palestinian deaths and no accountability. No one held accountable. War crimes identified and seen around the world, and no one held accountable because the United States continued to protect Israel in the United Nations. So we have this colonial reality that shapes so much of the history of the rest of the world. The Arab world has not forgotten British and French colonialism. You know, we hear about ISIS saying that the colonial border between Iraq and Syria is no more. The Sykes-Picot lines in the sand should be abolished. But they're hardly the first ones to say that. They're the first ones to take up arms to make it happen at a horrific human price. But they're not the first ones to say the colonial powers have destroyed our region, stolen our oil, destroyed our people. And the leftover colonial expansion is going on inside Israel, enabled by the United States, with the European Union rebuilding Gaza every time it's destroyed, and then standing back and not holding Israel accountable where it goes in and destroys it again. The irony, of course, we're talking about extremists. We're talking about the extremism of ISIS that operates in the name of Islam. In the settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, it's about 650,000 people who are violating international law every morning just by getting out of bed because their houses are built on illegally expropriated land. But only about 20% of them, maybe 25%, are extremists, either religious or nationalist extremists. The rest are what we might call yuppie settlers. They moved to the West Bank for the same reasons that people in this country moved to the suburbs. The air is cleaner, the houses are bigger, the lawns are greener, the swimming pools are sparklinger. What's not to like? And it's all subsidized by the Israeli government, helped along by our tax money. We pay $3.1 billion a year directly to the Israeli military. It's soon going to go up to five. The new 10-year agreement is being negotiated right now, and it looks like that's going to be part of the payoff to Israel after the Iran deal. The consolation prize is that it's going to go from $3.1 billion a year to the military to $5 billion a year to the military. $5 billion every year of our tax money going to the military of the 26th wealthiest country in the world for their military, which is known around the world for committing war crimes. Is that a good use of our tax money? Is that going to make us safer? These are the questions that are not being asked enough. We use the term apartheid when we talk about this colonial enterprise, not because it's a shocking term and it gets people talking about how can you say Israel is apartheid, it's not like South Africa. The answer is, of course, it's not like South Africa. It's completely different. That's not why we use the term. We use the term because it's the exact definition of apartheid that's included in the UN Covenant Against the Crime of Apartheid that was passed in 1973. That says that when you have a single territory with two separate legal systems governed by the same government, where people are divided on the basis of race or religion, national origin or language, that's the definition of apartheid. Look at the West Bank. Imagine a 12-year-old kid on the West Bank throws a stone. If that kid is an Israeli kid, he's going to be taken to a juvenile court, very much like our courts. They don't work well all the time, but the idea of juvenile courts is they are built to work in the interest of the child. The child is considered a child, even if they have committed a crime. The goal of the court is to help get the kid education and help whatever's needed to get the kid back on track. That's appropriate. That's what would happen to an Israeli kid in the West Bank. If that kid in the West Bank who throws a stone is a 12-year-old Palestinian kid, that kid appears before a military court. Israel is the only country in the world that has created a juvenile military court. At 14, Israeli kids are in a juvenile court up to 18. At 14, Israeli kids go before the regular military court, with all that that implies. So this is the definition of apartheid, and it's the reason that we talk about solutions that apply across the board. We need a solution to the war in Syria that's based on international law, human rights, and equality for all. We need an end to Israeli occupation and apartheid and a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that's based on international law and human rights and equality for all. Whether it's one state, two state, red state, blue state, that's not our call. That's not for the U.S. I'm a Jewish girl from California. I don't live there. Why should I get to say how many states there are? It's not my job. My job is to hold my government accountable for a policy to be based on international law and human rights and equality for all, instead of a policy that's based on supporting occupation and apartheid. In Syria, my job is to say we need to stop supporting militarization and war and start supporting diplomacy and negotiations. We need to stop paying billions of dollars to buy weapons and start paying billions of dollars to rebuild the countries we have destroyed. That's our job. That's the kind of work that we need to focus on. I want to end with 2 points. One is something that former Senator George Mitchell taught all of us, I think, after his work in the Good Friday Accord in Northern Ireland that he was instrumental in helping to craft. And after that very long process, which had been almost impossible at the beginning, partly because the British view was the Provisional IRA are terrorists and we will not talk to them. They cannot be in the room. And the lesson that Senator Mitchell brought back and what he had imposed at the time was, if you're serious about diplomacy, everybody has to be in the room. Not because you like them, but precisely because you don't. And if they're not in the room, they're not bound by whatever you decide. So this notion that we can have talks in Syria with the Syrian Kurds, who are admittedly the U.S.'s best friend in the region, who are fighting ISIS more than anybody else, but they can't be there because Turkey won't come if they're there, that's not going to work. You don't have to like what the Kurds stand for. You don't have to like what Turkey stands for. But they're on opposite sides, and if they're not both in the room, one or the other is going to scuttle the deal. So that's the pragmatism of it. That's the pragmatic part, that everybody has to be in the room. That's not idealist. That's being pragmatic. The one other thing I want to say is that this notion that the only option is the option of war is a very dangerous reality for our country. The idea of American exceptionalism, which is now touted as a given, something to be held up with pride by every candidate for president of every party. No one is willing to say, no, we are not exceptional. We are exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally powerful, but we are not an exceptional nation. We are a nation struggling to do what we claim to believe in, that we claim to believe in things like equality, and we struggle to make that real. We are not exceptional. We got a lot of work to do. But we do have obligations, the obligations that come with power and that come with money, all of those things that we have too much of. We don't have too much humility. We could use a little more of that. But it means that we need real policies. It's not enough to say we can't go to war. It's not going to work. The option is not walk away. The option is not, this is not a Rand Paul isolationism. You know, once in a while he says something very interesting on the need to end wars, the need not to send troops. I'm like, yeah, that sounds good. Until he gets to, yeah, and we have to pull out of the United Nations and stop dealing with any other countries. Okay, this is, you know, that's not going to work so well either. So what would a policy look like? If we are talking about a policy based on human rights and equality for all, and international law, maybe we start with the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. Stop killing more people. If you're trying to stop a war that has already in Syria killed more than 250,000 people, stop killing more people in the name of stopping the war. That could be number one. That's not a bad idea. Number two, you claim there are no boots on the ground. Make that real. Pull them out. Pull out the 3,700 troops that are on the ground in Iraq and the 50 or so that are officially on the ground in Syria. We don't know how many more. All those special forces and CIA ops, maybe they wear sneakers and not boots, but get them out too. Get them all out. Get all the shoes out. Get all the shoes out. They're making it worse and not better. Number three, stop sending more weapons for all these forces to be killing each other. Stop sending more bombs and bombers to the Saudis to kill more Yemenis. Stop sending more, whatever they're sending in tanks and trucks and more bombs and more bullets to the so-called Syrian opposition that the U.S. doesn't even know who they're sending it to, not least because almost all of it ends up in the hands of ISIS. Because ISIS is stronger. We remember why. One, they don't fight alone, they fight with others. Number two, they pay higher wages to their militias. That's one of the ironies of it all. Number four, five, six, ten, do better diplomacy. Put all of the money and energy and high-level attention into the diplomacy that we're now putting into the war. And in the meantime, stop the war to make that diplomacy real. Use the money to vastly increase our contributions to the United Nations to take care of refugees. The vast majority of refugees don't want to come here. They're not trying to invade our country. They don't want to be in the United States. They want to be able to go home. Some of them do have to be resettled, and we should take more. We should be taking 28% of those refugees who do need to be resettled. Why? Because we represent 28% of the wealth of the world, even though we only have 5% of the population of the world. The least we could do is say we will take 28% of those refugees who need resettlement. There's small things we can do. We could overturn the Supreme Court decision, Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. Why? Because that law makes it illegal for anyone in the United States to provide nonviolence training to any organization on the terrorism list. So if somebody could get to the PKK, the Kurdish Workers Party in Turkey, or ISIS for that matter, and train some of them in nonviolent techniques of protest instead of war, that would be a crime punishable by 20 years in a federal prison. How sensible is that? That's a small thing. We should be able to do that. We can increase economic pressure on the oil companies that are making a killing on ISIS oil. Now, what government is going to be prepared to put the pressure on the oil companies? That shouldn't be so hard, given that we claim that everything about our country is mobilized to stop terrorism, except, well, the oil companies, they're kind of exempt. There's a lot to do. And at the end of the day, we still owe a huge debt to the people of Syria. We still owe an enormous debt to the people of Iraq and Afghanistan and Yemen and Somalia, the countries where we are sending drones, the people of the countries that we have destroyed. Some of you will remember, looking around, I think many of you will remember, Colin Powell's claim during the Iraq War. Remember his famous statement that he used to say over and over again, the Pottery Barn line, you break it, you fix it. We have to fix Iraq. That was the wrong analogy. It's not about Pottery Barn. The right analogy is the bull in the china shop. What do you do when the bull gets loose in the china shop? You don't go in and ask the bull to fix all the cups. You get the bull the hell out of the china shop and write a check for the damage. That's what we need to be doing in Iraq. That's what we need to be doing in Afghanistan. It's going to be generations before these countries can reclaim their social existence, their lives, rebuild their cities. It's not going to help to have us standing there with guns telling them how to do it. That's the guarantee of failure. We need to guarantee success. We've had 15 years of a failed war on terror. I think maybe it's time for 15 years of paying the price for what we did wrong. Thank you.
Phyllis Bennis, concluding her talk on why there is no military solution to ISIS aggression. War cannot solve this problem, but diplomacy might. I'm glad Bennis reminded us of the long and bloody guerrilla war between the anti-British Catholic militant extremists and pro-British Protestant militant extremists in Northern Ireland. For most of my life, that bloody conflict seemed intractable, with no end in sight. Then it ended, with no military victory on either side. It ended after some serious diplomacy and negotiation. That conflict resolution was spearheaded by the United States. The international negotiation was chaired by Senator George Mitchell of the United States. An agreement was signed in 1998. The militant Irish Republican Army disarmed. The war quickly came to an end, and peace has endured. I remember the time well. This was a stunning victory for diplomacy. It was the only admirable instance of U.S. foreign policy that I can think of in my lifetime. Okay, that and Eisenhower's abrupt ending of Harry Truman's war against North Korea and China. Pretty much the first thing Eisenhower did when he took office in 1953. But since the 1998 Northern Ireland peace agreement was bad for the defense industry profits, after an initial splash, the U.S. media and the State Department have agreed to forget the whole matter. And so we did. So thank you, Phyllis Bennis, for the much-needed reminder. Speaking of issues that the media don't want to talk about, let's hear a bit of the Q&A that followed Dennis's speech. The questioner brought up Saudi Arabia's funding of ISIS and other terrorism throughout the world. How come nobody talks about that?
Why are you leaving out the elephant in the room, which is the active support, creation, funding by the United States, by its allies, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Israel, of ISIS and these other elements like ISIS?
The question of U.S. and Saudi support for ISIS is a longstanding issue. The U.S. support came in the form of creating the conditions which gave rise to ISIS and imprisoning the people who would ultimately create ISIS. The issue of where the money comes from is a very complicated one. Much of it, if you had to pick one country that the money for ISIS comes from, it comes from Saudi Arabia. We've known that for a long time. That's one of the big questions of what are the Saudis doing and not doing to stop the money from going through. It goes to the question of what is Turkey doing or not doing to prevent fighters from going through. That's an ongoing question. These are countries allied with the U.S. This is a huge challenge to the U.S. claims that it is against ISIS in all its forms when its allies have been responsible. One of the things we don't know, because the system in Saudi Arabia is so opaque, is the degree to which the money that goes from the Saudis to ISIS comes from the royal family versus coming from some government officials versus coming from pro-government institutions of various sorts versus coming from wealthy Saudi individuals or businesses. No one's been able to track that. We know it comes from Saudi Arabia. We don't know how much of it comes from the government or not the government. What we do know, and what nobody's hiding this, this is all over my book, which you can read. One of the things that we do know is that the Saudi system is tightly controlled enough that regardless of whether the money was coming from government sources or not, the government does have the capacity to stop it. It's choosing not to do that. The U.S. is choosing to not pressure them to do that because of relations of oil and relations of weapons sales. Those are still the things that define the U.S.-Saudi relationship. So yeah, that hasn't changed. I don't think that's the only elephant in the room, but yeah, it's one of the things that hasn't changed.
Not a very good answer to the question, I think, but a long one. The issue raised is important, though. It's also an issue the establishment doesn't want raised about 9/11. I happen to think that the government's official story of 9/11 is preposterous, and the official 9/11 Commission report is an inept attempt at whitewash. It's so bad, it makes you appreciate the highly skilled and much more credible whitewash that is the Warren Commission report on the assassination of John F. Kennedy. That's because the so-called Warren Commission was run by the brilliant master of deceit, fired CIA director Alan W. Dulles, whereas the 9/11 Commission was run by the right-wing neocon hack Philip Zelikow. But if we were to take the official story of 9/11 seriously, even that says that 16 of the 19 alleged hijackers were citizens of Saudi Arabia. The alleged mastermind was a prominent businessman of Saudi Arabia, and the whole 9/11 terrorist operation was funded mainly by money from, you guessed it, Saudi Arabia. So, the United States military revenge for 9/11 was directed at Afghanistan, which had fairly little connection to 9/11, and then at Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11 whatsoever. Now, I majored in English, not political science. So the fact that none of this makes any logical sense to me may be just a sign of my faulty education. I don't know. I do know, though, that we are out of time. Thanks again to Mike McCormick for the original recording. Thanks to Phyllis Bennis for a very good talk. And thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. Check out our archive of past shows at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good day, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao.